Marshall here. Welcome back to The Realignment. Quick note before I dive into today's episode. Sagar and I released the latest version of our Realignment Weekend Ask Me Anything discussion episode for Supercast subscribers. We offered a bit of a preview on Sunday. If you'd like to hear the full conversation, though, and submit your own questions, and of course, get the ad-free version of the Realignment podcast, go to realignment.supercast.com. Now, on to today's episode. I've got a great conversation with Tim Carney of the Washington Examiner and the American Enterprise Institute. He has a new book out. It's called Family Unfriendly: How Our Culture Made Raising Kids Much Harder Than It Needs to Be. I kind of start the podcast off this way, but it's really interesting that Tim Carney gets at this question of birth rates and childhood and actually raising families through the lens of culture. There are different ways you could think about this issue. You could focus on economics, like the actual cost of raising a kid, the actual cost of higher education, the cost of buying a house. You could look at technology. Jonathan has a new book out. It's all about how smartphones have potentially endangered generations of children. And of course, then you have the cultural aspect, the individual ways that our culture shapes our decisions in these categories. So this conversation gets at all of this. I'm having this conversation also as a non-parent myself, so it's always humbling to have that as well. Hope you all enjoy it. See you all next time. And a huge thank you to the Foundation for American Innovation for supporting the work of this podcast. Tim Carney, welcome to The Realignment.
Thank you. Thanks for having me.
Yeah, I'm glad to chat with you. So the book is called Family Unfriendly: How Our Culture Made Raising Kids Much Harder Than It Needs to Be. And I think my first question would be the use of the word culture in the sentence is interesting, because I think right now we're at this interesting, weird consensus point where folks would agree that it's harder to raise children than it needs to be. People probably aren't having as many kids as they'd want to have, but there are different sort of starting points people would begin from. So some people would start from economics. Like if I'm a socialist, I'd say, look, you know, the fact that we don't have universal healthcare in this country, yep, or we don't have paid sick leave like in Europe, that's why it's harder. Or you could be a Jonathan Haidt reader and say, hey, it's harder and harder to raise children today because technology's made it hard. The dating apps have made it hard to date in the first place. The apps have made it so that we're kind of like still stuck on things instead of like trying to have kids, et cetera, et cetera. You're focused on the question of culture. Why do you start from that point?
No, I think that's right. I sometimes think of the what's between the individual and the whole, sort of the way Alexis de Tocqueville talks about it. Because one story that I have in the book that sort of hit both of those extremes is I was walking through a neighborhood in Salt Lake City that, you know, Utah has one of the higher birth rates in the country. They, you know, bigger families, they're actually a relatively happy state. So like childhood anxiety, low birth rate doesn't seem to be affecting there, but a lot of Salt Lake City, it does. And this one neighborhood called the Lower Avenues that I thought should have a ton of kids because it had, you know, the right size houses, et cetera. I walked around, I didn't see any kids at all, any families. Finally, I ran into a couple, Isaac and Nicole. And I said, what do you guys think of family? They said, we're not going to have kids. And I said, why not? I said, it's too unaffordable. I said, what exactly is unaffordable? And Isaac said, everything, healthcare. But if I'm being honest, really, I'm just selfish. Other people are going to be watching Teletubbies and cleaning up vomit while we will be drinking margaritas in Paris. And aside from why you would travel to Paris to drink margaritas, I thought about those two answers, that it's unaffordable and selfishness. And unaffordable is this big macro thing, and selfishness is this individual thing. And I think both of them fall short because neither the unaffordability nor the selfishness has increased over the last 15 years, while childhood anxiety has increased and the birth rate has decreased. And so
– can I pause you real quick there to make sure I understand? It seems that some parts of raising children has become more affordable. So, for example, for a lot of people, they're going to wait to start having kids before they buy a house. Obviously, the price of housing has gone up. And then at the same time, the price of college has also gone up as well, too. So some parts of, I guess, having a family is more expensive.
I would say housing going up is obviously a barrier to family formation. The last 3 years has really seen that. The current baby bust started 15 years ago. before the pandemic.
So that's the,
So before the pandemic, we were down from, you know, 2.1 babies in 2006 to 1.7. So it's certainly an obstacle that needs to be addressed, housing affordability, but it can't be seen as the cause of these phenomena that are 15, 16 years old. So thanks. That's a great question. But I put selfishness at like zero until Adam and Eve eat the apple, and then it's been at 100. Like, humans are not more selfish today. But what we do is we...
One more pause, because okay. I actually read the book and I've actually listened to a lot of your work. So I have like so many questions here. I would say that like if we're going to scale out human selfishness on the Adam and Eve scale, it's probably consistent. But I think you could argue that cultural restraints to selfishness are probably at their weakest, in the sense that like if you take a 1950s dude and say to him, look, we're going to get rid of like marriage first culture. We're going to throw all the shotguns away so there's no more shotgun weddings. No one's going to shame you if you had a wedlock child. He probably would behave in the same ways that a man in the year 2020 would as well too. So that's just like the one addendum I'd add.
Well, but it's not an addendum. That's my exact point. That the job of culture is to mitigate our selfishness, to direct our personal interests towards the common good, to direct our short-term incentives towards the long-term incentives. That's what a culture does through norms. This is what some people think government should do, you know, in detail through law. And government does that to some extent on at the margins, but that really – a culture's norms and expectations and all the other things, that's about aligning our self-interest with the common good. And so right now, our culture is falling short on that. And so that's why I focus on that. Not that economics doesn't matter, not that individual choices don't matter, but that they're, if something's happening to a whole, if one person says, I don't want to have kids, well, that's normal. That's happened throughout history. I'm a Catholic. Mm-hmm. Our priests, our nuns, all sorts of people are signing up to not have kids. Not everybody's called to it. So it's sometimes a problem I run into. Oh, are you telling everybody to have kids? No. But I'm wondering why we're, as a culture, shifting this way. And so that's why I look at culture, not just economics. Economics is in there. Certainly not just government policy, but not that people are getting worse. But I think you stated it exactly right, that the culture is what sets up guardrails, mitigates and offsets our natural selfishness.
So that answer brings to mind some interesting follow-up. So we'll do it one at a time. So first follow-up, when would you argue then, and this is, and as you know, like the whole 50s nostalgia thing from the right and the left gets super complicated on a bunch of different levels, but we're speaking broadly in podcast terms. When would you say American marriage and family raising culture was probably at its most ideal in terms of like norms, expectations, those different dynamics?
So the positive development of the last 60 years has been... Well, I'll put it this way. In the 1950s, it was true that a lot of stay-at-home moms were unhappy with their lot in life, because they didn't want to be. But the educational and professional opportunities were not available to them. And I think this was suboptimal. This was not something I would classify as like a positive sacrifice. I think everybody does have to sacrifice. I think family is a great way to be drawn to sacrifice. But somebody choosing marriage obviously should be choosing it freely. And somebody choosing stay-at-home mom or stay-at-home dadness, it shouldn't be without trade-offs. Obviously, it will be. But it should be looking at the trade-offs and thinking, okay, given the trade-offs, this is what I want to do. So I don't know that we had a time that nails down sort of the self-determination of women with the pro-family norms. It happens in subcultures. It certainly happens in some subcultures in the U.S. But I would say when it was just kind of what you did to finish school, get a job and get married and have kids – that was sort of expected. Not everybody had to do it. It didn't work out that way for everybody, but that was the standard way you go about things. It's like wake up in the morning, go to the bathroom, have a cup of coffee. It's a standard way you go about things. If we can get that expectation and norm and combine it with a tolerance of people who choose different things, that would be a big benefit. And then similarly, if it's kind of expected, adults, the parents are going to sacrifice some of their career, whether it's mom, dad, or a combination of both. Those expectations have gone up and down. So I'm dodging your question by not naming a single time. In part,
well, no, but that's kind of the answer. I think, and this is why I think this can be a positive conversation, not in terms of like happiness, but in terms of like leading somewhere. It seems the cultural task we have to do is, okay, how do we reconstruct idealized end states given the world doesn't exist the way it used to exist?
And there's not going to be a time machine, and there's reasons not to take the time machine if it were there. And so I put a lot of that on dads in the workplace, that I've been blessed. I work at conservative institutions basically my whole 25-year career, and I've always had bosses who were dads and who said that their dadliness was more important to them than their career. And they acted and treated the men and women in the office accordingly, with official policies, with unofficial, informal arrangements. And so that's a big part of our problem now. And the reason sometimes we have really stupid public policy debates is that some people want there to be no trade-offs between family life and work life. And that's just impossible. And so we have to, a good conversation starts from the realization that work and family have trade-offs. And that's what I try to address in some of the later chapters, is how to make that both fit with equality and be pro-family.
You know, this is where this gets really interesting, though, because I, too, spend a lot of time working in like the center-right, center-left, nonprofit media and think tank spaces. And I also work at the University of Texas. So those are all institutions that, by a variety of definitions, even the private sector media companies aren't quite market-oriented in like a traditional way. So it's very straightforward for those institutions to say, hey, like part of the means, like, for example, like if I'm a conservative donor, I'd be incredibly bummed to hear that at AEI, actually all of your bosses are terrible and make you work to the like bone and not actually have a family. So like there are actual like reasons why you'd say like, hey, actually putting out good scholarly work that is actually undergirded by people who are living a lifestyle we believe in is actually important. But if you're just working, let's say like a marketing sales job, where once again, it's purely market oriented, it's purely volume driven. How do you think in that environment, bosses, owners, et cetera, could develop a healthy relationship around marriage, work, family, those things?
Well, so the first step would be realizing that marriage and parenthood are bigger deals than other things that workers might do outside of work. You know, somebody might be an Arsenal fan or whatever, Manchester United. Somebody might have cats. Somebody, you know, might really be into Taekwondo. You know, you should try to accommodate those things, but to actually make a value judgment, to sort of take away any pretensions towards neutrality and say, your family is going to matter. And not just marriage and parenthood, but also your siblings, your parents. And I think most employers do that. If you said, my father's sick, I want to go home. Okay, you go, you work from home when you can and just take off the time you can't. Don't worry about counting it. You know, we'll all pick up your slack. I think that's what most good employers would do. And similarly with kids, being explicit about that and asking employees what they need, providing flexibility, all of those things, I think that would produce returns, certainly in the long run, in loyalty. If you just think about it, if you're in a job and you just say, you know, last time we had a baby, they just gave me so much flexibility to work from home, to come in, to come back. I'm not going to give that up. That's just too valuable. And then also parents and married workers, there's a lot of data suggesting that they are more reliable. they do their job better. It makes you a little more grown up. It forces you to be a little more grown up. You're less likely to sort of have a kind of F you attitude if I'm just going to walk away. So there's all sorts of reasons on that could get complicated. I'm not an expert on that particular workforce issue. And so one thing would be, again, scheduling sort of accommodation of flexibility, really driving home that that's going to be good for parents. A key way is what I call sort of new dad or new mom jobs. Some people might want to go down to zero for the first 6 weeks and then start ramping up from home. And so I think as a journalist, I work at the Washington Examiner, being a Capitol Hill reporter or a campaign trail reporter, that does not go well with being a new parent. Like, okay, yeah, I'm going to be in Ohio. Some people maybe cart around their new babies. Good for them if they can pull that off, but it's not great. If you became an editor of letters or outside outside op-ed contributors, that's something you can do from home. And that it doesn't matter if you get back to somebody 6 hours later, you know, when the kids are napping, et cetera. So cultivating that. So not just, I call it sort of looking beyond parental leave, cultivating a job that somebody can do that fits into their family rather than trying to push them to fit their family into their job.
What I like about an undercurrent or kind of like a overarching aspect of what you're articulating here is just this idea that we have to accept trade-offs. And it feels like so much of what goes wrong for folks are they're discovering that the no trade-offs policy has actually not only been like disastrous, but actually like doesn't work. So like something that I'm starting to experience because I was born in 1992. So I'm towards like the tail end of like the millennial cohort. So I'm in my 30s and I'm starting to experience like, you know, women a few years older than me starting to realize like, hey, actually, it's not just as easy to have children in your mid 30s than you would have thought it would be. And options like freezing your eggs or like IVF are only like not as easy as you thought they'd be, but they're actually quite expensive and kind of like really, really tough in that way. So just understanding that there are just like trade-offs and you have to make those decisions and approaching your 20s, that would be like the number one lesson that I've really seen for kind of thinking about these things. A broader question I'd love to ask you is, we're in this weird moment for this topic. We've had, you and I talked about this in person when I saw you in DC. There have been three books in this broad family parenting reassessment period. So you've got Family Unfriendly by You, Brad Wilcox at UVA has Get Married, and then Melissa Kearney, who's kind of on the heterodox center left, she has two-parent privilege. I had Melissa on the podcast. I still need to reach out to Brad to have him come in on the show. But there's just been real ideological openness, I'd say, across the broad left to right spectrum to engage in these issues in a way that I don't think would have been true 5, 6, 7, 8 years ago. What do you think is happening at almost like meta narrative level in our society that's made people across the ideological spectrum, not just like, it's not that they're agreeing with your solutions, but they're open to the idea and the problem you're identifying?
That's a real good question, because when I started talking about a book that was going to address low birth rates, I started thinking about it 5 years ago after my last book came out. And when I would make tweets about it, people would just be like, what are you, a creepy weirdo? Why are you talking about what women are doing with their bodies? I was like talking about the number of babies being born. That's sort of a bigger thing than that. But no, it was this weird personal. But then I noticed in Europe, they were already talking about it. 10, 12 years ago in Europe, they've been saying, okay, how can we turn around the falling birth rates? Is this a problem? Can we patch it up with immigration? The conversations that were just not had, and still in a lot of sort of circles aren't had. When I've gone on media, some people have had to almost apologize for the fact that we were going to talk about birth rates. And so that has started happening. One thing is, I do think the pandemic brought a lot of it home. We did have a real quick drop in the birth rates, and then we didn't quite ever make up for that. We just returned back to the downward trend beforehand. Childhood anxiety has become much more into focus from the year of sort of forced, unplanned, accidental homeschooling. And the lockdowns, I think, exacerbated it. But then people noticed, wait a second, this has been a trend that was going on before the lockdowns. So I don't know. When there's a pandemic that disrupts your whole society, it's hard not to assume that that's part of it. But also, I think the parents have learned the lesson of technology being a bit of a problem in a way that they didn't, you know, when did we first start getting iPhones? That was 2007.
Seven. Yeah.
And so 2010, people started handing their first generation iPhone down to their kids when they got the next generation iPhone. And so nowadays parents are starting to realize, okay, this is a bit of a problem. And I think that actually is part of the culture. What I argue in the book is that there's this LA Times story saying this is the biggest technology story when the iPhone came out. I say, I think it was more of a cultural story. It's changed the way we interact. I think it has changed marriage and all of that stuff. So all of these things, for some reason, it took us a lot. We were a lot more uneasy talking about birth rates before, and it's just starting to open up now. So that would be my question. Why was Europe earlier to talk about it than we were? Maybe just because they were further along?
Their collapses, it seems like at a population level, especially in countries like Italy, the collapses were just far harder, much bigger. Because the U.S. is still a little outside of the norm in like the developed industrialized world around the number of children not only people want to have, but like that they do have. So I feel like that would probably be a part of it. So here's a good way I think of framing it, because I liked your kind of articulating how in the 20-teens it felt kind of or not – on your part, obviously, especially considering you're Catholic, but there was a lot of like mainstream ickiness around this topic. I think the easy way to frame this from a cross ideological, here's the problem, here's how you should examine this perspective is, look, like you've talked about this on the podcast and in the book, survey 2.7, that's the average number of children an American woman wants to have. You know, that's not, you know, Tim Carney or the Pope saying, like, you want to know, like, this is the number, it's 2.7. Yet people only have 1.6. That gap obviously is a, it doesn't necessarily have to be a public policy issue or problem that has to be solved for child tax credit, but it's actually an interesting question that needs to be examined. Why is there a gap between what they say? Like, that doesn't mean we need to talk about like replacement rates and birth rates and race and migration. Like, there's this actually straightforward number, like native born Americans have less children than they say they want to have. Let's examine that. So I guess the real question I'll ask that I framed it that way to you is, if you look at the, you know, basic demographics, basic economics, like the richer a country gets, the fewer number of children you're going to have in the first place. So what would you say is the gap between, obviously, as the Industrial Revolution progressed, as we got richer and richer as a society, we weren't going to have a world where, like, no offense, six, eight, nine children families were the norm. There's a gap between that just naturally falling and that 1.6 number. So like, what do you kind of see as like the gap between what's, because people are trying to dismiss this stuff by saying, look, obviously the number is going to go down, we're getting richer, but it seems like the gap is way too big relative to what the natural decline should have been.
No, that's right. I think the, obviously children are the, the return on investment in children is a lot smaller in a post agricultural world. I mean, my kids can mow the lawn and babysit the younger ones and run to the store to pick stuff up. And one of them's really good at assembling IKEA furniture. But
if you want to give a pitch for people to have six kids, I'm just imagining each specializes in one thing that you're bad at. So I've got one kid I've got one kid who's crushing IKEA, this other kid, man, hanging paintings, like, I just moved, so these are the problems I'm dealing with. So one of the six, they could, but if you only have two kids, no specialization, this is basic economics.
No specialization. I just thought of it recently when one was naturally better with the tools. And so then the oldest boy the other day, my wife was like, my grocery store run didn't happen. You got to make dinner with what's in the fridge. And she wasn't going to be back in time to cook. And so my kids were like, Dad, we got it. They make a chicken parm, which is amazing. And so that idea of like, I am now the fifth best cook in my house is such a, like, a great relieving thing. But now I'm forgetting.
I do think that
from six kids down to 2.7 is partly explained by, and six kids would have been the ideal. I don't know that it was ever the ideal, but above three or four was the ideal before World War II, before birth control pill, etc. So I think a lot of that drop, the original drop was due to children become more in an industrialized society where production has moved out of the home. Children become more of a liability and less of an asset.
Cost center.
Yes. And the other is opportunity costs for women specifically, that there's increased ability for the second earner to earn lots of money. There's increased ability for women to go to school. Starting a family when you're 25 might mean you don't get a master's degree, which wasn't as much of an option for women. So those things have brought it down. What I, the 2.7, which is what in Gallup polls they say is the Americans say is the ideal family size. And that's as true for men and women. It's a little lower for millennials, their ideal family size. I mean, for Gen Z adults, but
is it still above replacement rate of 2.1 for Gen Zs?
Yes, it's definitely above. Yeah. So the ideal is always above 2.1 and the actual is 1.7. And so that gap is what I call the sort of the deficit of flesh and blood that we're doing. And again, ideal, we don't have public policy mandate to give everybody their ideal. My ideal house has a big front porch on it. And I don't expect anybody to write a book, have a podcast, or talk in Congress about how to give everybody a house with a giant front porch. But this is a very specific, very important thing. And that's why, again, I say it deserves special attention. We shouldn't just treat it as another lifestyle choice. Some people have boats. Some people don't. Some people have single family home. No, this is something that really matters to people. And so we should have a discussion. Are there parts of our culture that are making that as that one baby gap from 2.7 to 1.7 happening? Are there ways to address it that will actually work without unacceptable, unintended consequences?
And now, a quick word about the A16C podcast. Hey, it's Marshall. In an exponential era, it's more important than ever for our country to have alignment between policymakers, founders, and funders. However, it's rare that we find all of them in the same room. Luckily, the A16Z podcast from Andreessen Horowitz just dropped a brand new series on American dynamism focused on exactly this. Coined by Realignment friend and A16Z general partner Catherine Boyle, American dynamism is a movement that embodies the spirit of innovation. And this new four-part series, recorded in the heart of Washington, D.C., covers topics including intelligence in the era of AI, the nuclear renaissance, and the future of defense. Guests include the CIA's first ever chief technology officer, Nand Mulchandani, the Department of Energy's Assistant Secretary for Nuclear Energy, Dr. Catherine Huff, and director of the DoD's Defense Innovation Unit, Doug Beck. Not to mention the founders of ambitious companies rivaling the status quo, like microreactor company Radiant, AI pilot company Shield AI, and advanced autonomous systems company Anduril. So don't miss out. Go check out the A16Z podcast and their new series on American dynamism on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you're listening now. So here's something I'm curious about. So I have the benefit. My wife works in venture capital. So like she spends a lot of time in SF. I still like we live in Austin, but I also like still go to DC a lot. And during COVID, we lived in New York City and I grew up in Portland, Oregon. So I've actually lived across like five or six different, parenting cultures, standards, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. And I'd be curious to you, when you're articulating what the problem is when it comes to cultural expectations around children, to what degree are these problems universal versus like subculture ones? So for example, in a podcast, you're talking about how like, hey, like you kind of described the tiger mom phenomenon, like AKA, like think of like Amy Chua. She's been on the podcast where we like Amy Chua, but like Battle Hymn of the Tiger Mother comes out in 2011. And it really describes like a Chinese American slash like upper middle class, like educated white collar dynamic around like getting your kids into Harvard, Yale, Princeton, being very, very intensive about activities, traveling sports, like et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. And you pointed out like that's a way that like if that's like your expectation culturally for your children, that's going to A, like cause you to like kind of over focus like attention on children in a way that like isn't culturally healthy or is like frankly parentally sustainable. But B is also going to just basically over dedicate resources. But as I'm sitting in Austin, Texas, and I'm surrounded by everyone with their like SEC schools, like outside of their front yards, I don't get the sense that my new neighbors are like breaking their 10-year-olds over getting into Princeton. That was very much like an East Coast like phenomenon, super zip phenomenon. So I guess how universal would you say is like, are these struggles relative to like there are specific subcultures?
It's certainly began in over intensive parenting began as an upper middle class, upper class phenomenon, but cultural trends often tend to trickle down from there. And mm-hmm. I ran focus groups that informed some of what I was going to focus on in this book. And I found working class guys who don't have kids, they're unsure whether they ever will. Multiple of them said, I don't want to give my kids a bare minimum. I'm not going to have children until I'm ready to give them the best of everything, which was not the way my parents talked. And I think it became sort of unthinkingly a way of parents talking, because you don't want to give your kid the worst of everything. But at some point you're like, yes, I'm going to microwave these scrambled eggs because it's just going to get protein into my child's body and have as little fuss as possible. Normal people are not, despite what you might think from TikTok, making their children homemade cornflakes or homemade grilled cheese sandwiches. If you've ever seen the TikTok mom, like Uber moms doing these ridiculous things. Maybe that is the best of everything. Like grilled cheese sandwiches look really good, but we don't have to do it. But that idea through social media, through other cultural forces, is trickling down. So the problem of overintensive parenting that I cover in chapters 1 and 2 of Family and Friendly is a upper middle class issue primarily, but it is definitely trickling down to the working class and the middle class. And you sort of asked about geography. One thing, the most interesting geography I found was that in the Mountain West in Utah, where I used to make fun of West Coasters or Mountain West people, where I'd say, do you play any sports? And they'd say, yeah, mountain biking. Like mountain biking is whatever. It's more intense than baseball, which I did. It involves more skill. It's more likelihood of dying. But it's not a sport. There's no scoreboard. There's no teams for most of the part. There's no ball. You need a ball for it to be a sport. But then I realized how family friendly these things could be, where it's like, my son gets his activity. He loves basketball, but then, he also goes snowboarding. We don't let him do travel sports because he wants to do snowboarding and hiking. And just those outdoor things that can be solo, that can be family oriented, that the sort of outdooriness of the Mountain West added that ability to do things that are fun and active, and there's no coach telling you when to do it. Because that's one of the huge travel sport problems is dads always tell me, moms, I hate the fact that the swim coach dictates my family schedule. And if what you're going to do as your activity is, whitewater rafting as a family, then you dictate your family schedule. So that was one of the interesting geographical variations that I saw.
You know, that's interesting because I'm glad you focused on travel sports, because I'm trying to really not say this condescendingly, but when you were describing, even when you're interviewing like working class guys about like, I'm going to give my kid the best, my kind of instant thought was like, okay, like what does that mean in a working class sense, right? So like that doesn't mean a European vacation in December. It doesn't mean we have a nice place at the Plaza Hotel that we always rent out for Christmas week in New York City.
Yeah.
Right. This was then, like, you and I have lived in a very specific world where, like, we know people who actually are doing that.
Yes.
It also doesn't mean I'm hiring the greatest SAT tutor you've ever seen to make sure I could get my kid into a top tier UC school or Princeton. But I think if you're probably thinking of a working class guy saying they're giving the kids the best, that's going to manifest itself in sports.
Exactly.
And travel sports especially. So yeah, talk about like
and hiring the role coaches.
That travel sports are playing. Yeah.
So I tell a story of Pete Zaccalillo. He was a major leaguer for a month. He got called up. He played with
what the Brewers. What a great name, by the way. That's just a pleasing name to hear someone say.
So I was Pete's teammate on a basketball team and a baseball team, which goes to show you how things have changed, because I was not very good at either of these sports. But everybody played on their varsity squad. And so Pete played varsity soccer, varsity basketball, varsity baseball. Senior year, the league profile for us, our team had won the league the year before. His senior year, it says like Zaccalillo will not be returning, because as a high school senior, he was specializing by dropping his third best sport. He still played basketball that year. We won the title, dropping his third best sport to play a second season of baseball because he was getting recruited by Division I schools. And that was extraordinary enough to be the front page headline of the local sports section. nowadays,
now it's kids obvious. Are, that's like, what's the catch? Like, yeah, of course. Like, why would
nowadays
allocate kids your resources effectively?
Exactly. Are specializing as 12-year-olds into one sport and playing it year round. Pete Zocalillo now runs a baseball program where he has to tell the parents, no, no, stop. Like, send your, I mean, it's his money coming in to his door, but he tries, your kid will be better off playing basketball than having my pitching coach work with him over winter. And this is not just rich kids. To some extent, it is middle class, working class people thinking, you know, Johnny's left arm might be our ticket to a college scholarship. Or just, you love sports. What good red-blooded American doesn't love sport? Oh my gosh, this kid, he's going to be killer. I cannot wait for him. And that's just a regular dad instinct that's not necessarily caught up with this hyper-achievement mindset. But it's one I tell a story in the book that I had to overcome, where when my son was playing Little League one, was playing infield on this kind of travel team once, he said, hey, Dad, can you come hit me fly balls? I was like, no, we really need to work on your infield defense. So let's go to a different field that has a better infield. He's like, but you can just hit me fly balls behind our house. And we went back and forth. And finally, I realized, he said, Dad, fly balls, I just think are more fun. He wanted variation from what he was getting in baseball practice. He wanted to play ball with Dad, the greatest, most American thing. And I was like, no, this is a training session, son.
No, that's this is so, and you kind of like see this in the way that we've changed the athletes we idealize, but think of Bo Jackson and Michael Jordan in the 1980s, where the two of them being multi-sport athletes, baseball and basketball in the case of Michael Jordan, and then Bo Jackson, it's football, baseball, and track and field. Like, those were seen as like really ideals. But for, I think, a lot of folks, if you're not operating on the Bo Jackson and Michael Jordan genetic profile level, it's just so hard from a game theory perspective to accept the idea that actually this is not only healthy and okay, but actually isn't going to be a real cost. So I kind of like, here's the question for you then, like, especially this is the culture side of things. How do you suggest, and I'm not a parent yet, so I literally can't claim any knowledge of this. How do you suggest parents get out of the prisoner's dilemma of how do I be that? Because once again, this is an emerging discourse. How do I be that first parent that says, you know what, actually, even though all the other cool Joneses next door are going to that specialized like training camp, I'm just going to let Johnny run track and field because honestly, he enjoys it, even though he's not quite set for like making the varsity squad 3 years from now. Like, how do you suggest an actual parent think about that?
Yeah. So, and I'm glad you phrased it that way because that's why I call it the travel team trap. In the book, I acknowledge some parents, this is all they want for their kids. And others are like, I have to do it. If I wanted to have a chance of making the JV team, I have to do it. He'll be considered a shirker if he takes winter off of sports. And so there is a bit of a collective action problem here, and that you can theoretically start the momentum going the other way by sticking your neck out. One, the easiest argument, even if you're just thinking about sports, is to say what I quote an athletic director in the book saying, it's just probably not going to work. Hire your kid a pitching coach, have him dedicate his life to this, have him give up his other hobbies. There will be some other more athletic kid who's just decides, I'm done with lacrosse. Let me try baseball. And then boom, your son loses his starting job. Second, what Pete Zocalillo says is the wear and tear on the bodies from the lack of cross training and the lack of rest really harms. And I cite all sorts of studies about that. It harms their psychology as well, where they actually lower not just their enjoyment of their youth because they're not doing as much sort of hanging around and having fun, but also their own assessment of their physical athletic ability because they're always comparing themselves to everybody else. This has become a job. And then you climb up the ladder and you end up at the state swim meet where you finish 40th and you're like, I'm the 40th best 16-year-old backstroker when that's been my whole life since I was age 10. Just in the state of Maryland, this is wild. And so unless they're lucky enough to be in that top 1%, they'll feel a diminished sense of achievement. The deeper argument, though, is childhood is supposed to be expansive. Like, if you don't let them get exposed to – you can't make your kid like something. If you don't let them get exposed to other things, you're not going to know what they like. I have a son who just really got into soccer. I had no idea he'd be into soccer, both soccer and football. He obviously isn't going to play both of those, but maybe just playing flag football for me, playing tackle, pickup football with my friends is one of my favorite parts of growing up. And so that expansiveness that you, it's a humility, right? A humility that's behind conservative free market thinking is, well, we don't know. You just got to try a bunch of stuff and something's going to work. If they're specializing, they're not getting that expansive childhood. So you're missing out on the opportunity for them to learn what they love doing and what they will focus more of their time on in adulthood when a little bit of specialization is more appropriate.
I love that because I just find that in general, you're never going to convince anyone of anything via offering us like a prescribed specific path. But I think frameworks are so helpful. And I love the expanse of this thing because I was thinking about this because Olivia, my wife and I were driving by our elementary school, our local elementary school this morning. I was sort of like, man, out of all of the ages of childhood, I miss like fourth grade. I saw a bunch of like fourth grade looking kids. And what did I miss? It's the expansiveness, yep. Right? It's actually that I literally could do anything. I could do anything versus like my adult time where I'm like, okay, well, we were out at 7 a.m. because like I'm flying to DC later today. So I was like, okay, so like you need to go to the gym for 30 minutes because you're unhealthy when you travel. And then you need to come back because you have to prep for like your episode of Tim Carney and you have to like go to the airport. Like that's like my adult life is the opposite of, and then when I was at the gym, by the way, I had to choose between listening to podcasts you did and like listening to music on the treadmill. And I chose the podcast you did and they were very good podcasts. I've sometimes regretted doing that. I would have listened to the podcast even if we didn't have an interview. So like that gamble worked out well, but like my adult life, I think your adult life, anyone's adult life is the definition
of optimizing like, every minute. Yeah. Do not optimize your child's every minute.
And yeah, so just thinking of the phrase of like, am I letting, cause I'm going to maybe try to hold myself to this rule. Like, am I giving my child a life where they felt like they had for a period options, possibilities, expansion. So yeah, I'm just thinking out loud here. Cause that captures what I was, I think, missing when I was thinking of, fourth grade. Okay. So in this last section, couple broad questions. So obviously, you've hinted at their like, you know, public policy aspects here. You're supportive of like a child tax credit expansion, but you, like, I think anyone reasonable on this topic, like knows that like to a certain degree, that's not like make or break, in terms of like these numbers, like, you know, we passed the bill and it's not as if like we're hitting that 2.7 number. I would like to hear though, at a broad level, what are like some macro ways that government affects society that could maybe make a difference? So for example, if there's more housing availability, if there are alternative options to college. So you're not thinking to yourself like, hey, like I have to, you know, spend 200K for state school. Maybe like we don't need that or can't afford the third kid. If there are alternate options like apprenticeship programs, et cetera, like that's more possible. What are like macro ways that you think government can maybe, I think, broadly change the way people think about these trade-offs?
So the biggest thing I would say that's definitely a government responsibility is infrastructure. The infrastructure of family would be oriented towards kid walkability and bikeability. So we have all sorts of friends who talk about walkability, and my friend Megan McArdle always jokes. They make this number one issue out of the fact that they want to be able to stumble home from a great cocktail bar. And I have nothing against stumbling home from a great cocktail bar. I think it has lots of social benefits, including meeting your neighbors, et cetera. But I want my kids to be able to go and play pickup basketball without needing to get a ride, get to their friend's house, walk around the neighborhood and bump into people, ride their bikes and get exercise and explore an expansive childhood. And so that involves trade-offs. And in a lot of suburban America, the cars have won in every trade-off battle. The roads are wider. There are no sidewalks, fewer crosswalks, higher speed limits. And so that feeds into a bigger thing, which is just community. So this is what my book 5 years ago was about. Alienated America was a collapse of local community. So what can be done to stand up institutions that bring people together? In my life, the church is a central institution, the local congregation, but also the lesson from Bowling Alone, that would be, mm-hmm. you know, that people need to gather, know their neighbors, be engaged in something, ideally something with a higher goal than just a bowling league, but whatever it is will be. So building and coming together, that cuts against some of the idea of modern school systems. I think, okay, there are efficiencies the more that we consolidate. So a high school mm-hmm. with 2,500 kids will means, you know, some economies of scale. I would cut against it. I would say, well, and I would specifically ask, what would help parents get to know other parents? Mm-hmm. We don't need a social program to help every problem, but we do need a social system, a social life to do it. And that's going to involve community. So that is absolutely where I would start, is helping kids wander the neighborhood so parents aren't taking them everywhere, and help parents and kids get to know more people and just do the sort of collective job of raising up the next generation without needing to call on some government program. I have things about the tax code in there. I think, again, those are of secondary importance. I wanted to come up with a solution of, we need to quadruple the tax credit, or the tax child tax credit does nothing. That would have been a little more viral if I could have written that op-ed. Yeah. But in the end, I decided what we have now, but slightly bigger, would be the optimal kind of tax credit.
No, and I think that a last point on that, and this is where this gets interesting. Like, you in a bunch of your podcasts, you discuss like the free range kid dynamic, and all the debates were on like, hey, when I was growing up, it was super chill for me to walk 3 miles to elementary mm-hmm. school. No one said anything. But today, like, there are open questions on whether or not that's true in all parts of the country. And the interesting place where local government especially can make a difference here is, it is actually fair to ask, well, like, how actually unsafe is it for a kid to walk to the elementary school? And to what degree can local community-centric efforts make that actually easier? So, like, if you're right next to a highway and there really aren't any, like, sidewalks, it's actually not insane to be like, hey, parents, we need to talk. Here's another one, too. Do your kids go to public school?
No, they're in Catholic school.
So something that I saw that kind of, like, depressed me, once again, I live by this, like, public school, like, in Austin, Texas. Everyone was getting dropped off by their parents yep. in their cars and weren't riding the school buses. And that was a real like, wow, that feels really, really different. I mean, even by the school bus, this was particularly depressing. I'm by the school bus stop, and then this one parent was waiting in their giant, like, upper middle class suburbs, like suburban, like mm-hmm. Chevy Suburban, and then let their kid out when the bus arrived.
Wow.
And there were a bunch of kids, like, on the side separately. So, like, that's just kind of like, there are just these, like, really interesting. It's hard to write about all these things in just, like, one book, but, like, there are just these, like, really interesting
yeah.
slight, like, even in a 15, 20 year period, even from the same generational cohort, changes that I can't just, like, perfectly narratively explain, because, like, it's not as if, you know, the school bus is unsafe. I get like parents feeling unsafe about school shootings, but it's not as if we had like a mass incident of school bus crashes. So parents are like, you know what? Like, we can no longer trust the school buses as a means of getting to school. I don't quite know why that's happening, but I think it's really fascinating.
So some of the parental fear is unfounded based on media magnifying these one in a million things and making them seem like they happen everywhere every day. And some of it, though, is due as that's why I focus on the sort of walking. Like, it is actually true that your kid is more likely to, you know, get hit by a car in a place that doesn't have sidewalks and in a place that does. It's not actually true that your kid is more likely to get kidnapped or murdered today than he was 40 years ago. It's the opposite, right? It's so much mm-hmm. safer from crime, even after the little post 2020 crime wave that's receded in almost all of the country, except Washington, D.C. But it's even in D.C., it's safer today than it was in 1980. And so some of it is parents fearing stuff irrationally, and some of it is, yes, we should and can make it better and safer and easier for kids to roam the neighborhood.
So two last questions here. So on a podcast, you mentioned that you rent. Mm-hmm. You have six kids, you rent, and you live in Virginia. And I'm thinking about earlier in the podcast, you said that, like, for a lot of men, like, regardless of class, they think to themselves, like, I want to give myself or my kids, like, the best. So that was a bit of a Freudian slip. When I said I want to give myself, actually, I mean my kids the best. No, that's sport camp is for him, not me being alpha dad at, you know, soccer practice. Yeah. No, but the I think a lot of people struggle with these different transition points. So when I heard you say you rent and you have six kids, I was like, oh my gosh, like I would never start trying to have kids mm-hmm. until I bought a house. Renting, that's a different stage of life. So like, how do you suggest people, given how many different lifestyle choices we have nowadays, mm-hmm. how should people think about when they make decisions without needing to stick to like a script? Because like, to be honest, like I'm 32. I definitely think it was a mistake to say to myself arbitrary, because it was arbitrary. Arbitrarily, I said, kids are for when you own a home, not for when you're renting. Mm-hmm. But that's a social construction. I make the same amount of money I make. I have the same job. Like nothing's actually changed. I have the same wife. I'm married. Yeah. How do you suggest people not just be constrained by frameworks?
So one thing, I once read this chess magazine. I was trying to learn to play chess because my daughter beat me when she was like 8. I was like, I can't let this keep happening. And so I started reading this chess magazine. There was this interview and this guy explained that non-chess people, when he talks to other journalists, they always say, how many moves ahead do you think? As if it's the same answer at any given point in the chess game. And unless you're like closing out and can force moves, he's like, you think about 3 moves ahead. And what you think is, I have no idea what's coming my way. I'm going to have the humility to accept that, and I'm going to try to put myself in the best position for whatever might come my way. But the important part there is the humility. You have no idea what's going to come your way. You have no idea how your likes are going to change, your personality. And so one option is to try to plan everything out detailed. Another option that actually tends to go hand in hand with this, even though it sounds like the opposite, is to just always leave your optionality wide open. Both mm-hmm. of those things are going to, I think they're a very modern error, and that's just sort of jumping in. On this very specific question, nobody's ever actually ready to have kids. My wife and I, my wife said, are they going to let us take her home? we didn't pass any course. We didn't get any book and pass a test to do it. We felt like we were kids. Like we felt like the hospital people were going to, that they actually had control over this baby, and we only got mm-hmm. to take her if they approved of us. And so that idea that you're ever going to be ready, that is an error, and that starting family does, it helps you. it helps you become a harder worker. It helps you put things in perspective. It helps you realize what doesn't matter. And you can't understand what it's like from the other side of the river. And once you cross over, you see things that you never saw before.
So here's the final question. This really ties into Jonathan Haidt's book release, which is coinciding, definitely not purposely, obviously, with the release of this episode on Tuesday, the 26th. I'd say the Overton window about government intervening in a lot of these socio-culture issues is probably the widest it's ever been. Mm-hmm. So not only do you have, you know, in Texas, basically like major porn sites were just basically kicked out of Texas because like the Texas state government, as with Virginia state government, a bunch of state governments have started really aggressively enforcing porn age verification laws in ways that porn companies argue that, you know, they can't really commit. And I think to the surprise of, I think, the porn industry, they've gotten very little support. On the center mm-hmm. left, everyone's basically okay with this happening to a certain degree. Like no one wants to jump out in front of things and say, you know what, I'm the person who's going to make it so it's basically easy for 14-year-olds to look at porn. But then you see with Jonathan Haidt, you see, you know, advocating for laws around banning social media for children under 16, which, you know, is a little complicated because mm-hmm. actually if you look at the terms and conditions, like for a bunch of the social media apps, it says no one under 13 and they're not very like aggressively enforced. I'm curious, as someone who's like quasi-libertarian in your politics, at least from my reading of you, how do you think about this new space where clearly left, right, and center see these challenges, especially from a technological perspective, as so pervasive that they are willing in new ways to take government as a means of addressing the harms or the problems?
So I'll try to quickly answer in 3 points. A, I'm skeptical of government intervening. My libertarianism is a conservatism, not because I think if, you know, Pornhub pulls out of Texas that people have lost anything good or some fundamental right. No, I think Texans are better off if nobody can access Pornhub there, okay? But because I don't know what the consequences are going to be. And mm-hmm. anytime you pass these laws, and especially cracking down on social media for teenage, like, I don't know how this is going to get in force and what the consequences are going to be, especially because it's new technology. So that's sort of a reason for my resistance. Two, every time somebody says we need a law to do this, you know, keep kids off of TikTok, there will be obnoxious people on Twitter who say, no, you're a bad parent. It's not the government's job to step in for you. But that obnoxious person is a little bit right that the government stepping in could make things worse. But parents actually do need support in resisting these forces. So I said, my wife and I, we sent our kids to Catholic school, and we talked to the parents. Once we became the old parents and we started having our younger kids and we started talking to them earlier, we said, we don't give our kids social media. We don't give them smartphones. You don't have to either. And you might regret it if you do. And then there's some solidarity. Your kids cannot truthfully say all my friends have smartphones, because, you know, us three families, we're not doing it. So you don't have to. So that community support really helps. And one reason people always turn to government is because they don't imagine community stepping in. So I guess those would be the
And this is, I think, what speaks to your previous book, or they don't have that community in the first place.
Exactly.
And that's like the really difficult, like, in between space. Like, if you don't go to church, if you dismissed a bowling league, but even a bowling league would be a good starting point for a lot of people that we know.
Yes.
Great. Well, Tim, this has been really great. Thank you so much for joining me on The Realignment.
Thank you, Marshall.
Hope you enjoyed this episode. If you learned something, like the sort of mission, or want to access our subscriber-exclusive Q&A, bonus episodes, and more, go to realignment.supercast.com and subscribe to our $5 a month, $50 a year, or $500 for lifetime membership rates. See you all next time.